Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Military History Inside Out podcast. In this week's episode, I speak with Dr. Mara Carlin about her new book that deals with U.S. building up of the militaries of fragile states from just after World War II to present day. We talk about the various case examples she used for her research, the conclusions she came to. We actually end up spending a fair amount of time on Lebanon issues, especially U.S. involvement in Lebanon in the 1980s. So that's really interesting. So this is definitely a good episode for professionals interested in international affairs and in U.S. military affairs. But there's also definitely a fair amount of history about the Vietnam War, for example, as I said, Lebanon, Greece just after World War II, and other interesting issues. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Dr. Mara Carlin, author of Building Militaries in Fragile States, Challenges for the United States. Thank you for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So first, tell me, how did you get into history and writing about history? And I know this is more of a political science book, but it gets into military history of a sort.
Absolutely. So my interest in this topic was really sparked when I was a policymaker at the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. This was throughout the aughts, and I was working on exactly this front, building militaries in fragile states. And I was working on building militaries in places like Pakistan and Lebanon, and sitting next to me were the people working on building the Afghan military and the Iraqi military. And it really got me thinking, so what if the U.S. also tried to do this exact same thing, and when has it been more successful?
Mm-hmm. Before your policymaker work, were you had you studied this subject, or you know, how did you get into it?
Mm-hmm. So I actually come at defense issues from an early interest in Middle East issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I had been interested in Middle East affairs. I had lived in the region when it was a little bit quieter than it is these days.
Mm-hmm.
And I left the region right as the Second Intifada erupted. So this was this kind of uprising that in many ways destroyed prospects for a peace process at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it really got me thinking, well, the way that one would bring the region together in some sort of meaningful manner would be through security issues. And so I went and got my master's degree in strategic studies and Middle East studies at Johns Hopkins site.
Mm-hmm.
And I started actually at the Pentagon as a lowly unpaid intern,
mm-hmm.
Which, of course, blew my mind and was an extraordinary experience.
Mm-hmm. So I see that you have written a lot of articles and such. Is this your first book, or, you know, how much writing did you do before this?
This is my first book. I've written a lot of articles, as you noted, and op-eds and what have you, but this is the first of the big kahuna that is a book.
Okay. So tell me about the book then.
Sure. So the book tries to answer the question, when, why, and under what circumstances can the United States be more successful when it's building militaries in fragile states?
Mm-hmm.
And it really is focused on this issue of effectively recognizing that there's increased state fragility post-1945.
Mm-hmm.
This fragility increasingly affects the United States, especially post-9/11, but the United States doesn't want to deal with these problems ourselves. We don't want to send the U.S. military to try to fix these problems for a bunch of reasons. Sensitivity towards casualties, constrained fiscal environment, the kind of increased focus on great power competition. And so effectively, how do you stabilize fragile states cheaply in blood, in treasure, and in time?
Mm-hmm.
And so what the United States has effectively done historically is it's tried to work by, with, and through others, right? So to delegate authority so that partner militaries can deal with these problems instead of the U.S. military having to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at a number of case studies qualitatively to try to figure that answer out. When has the United States been more successful and why? And how do we need to reshape our efforts to try to build militaries.
So what are some of the, or what are the case studies you used? Where did you look at?
Sure. So I looked at cases across Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. And effectively, what I look at is kind of a wide array of cases to try to ascertain what does success look like and what are the different types of failure. So I have kind of a spectacular failure example, which I'll spend a moment on. It's South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And it's South Vietnam in the 50s, which is a somewhat understudied period of U.S. involvement. Effectively, the United States had paid for the French effort in South Vietnam for the first half of the 50s. That failed. And so then, the U.S. military spent the next half of the decade trying to build the South Vietnamese military. It was a massive effort. It involved half a billion in assistance, hundreds of personnel. And yet, South Vietnam's president reorganizes the military according to his preferences. He prepares it for a conventional external conflict with North Vietnam. He leaves it ill-equipped for a growing communist insurgency at home. And the military's leadership remains weak. Its chain of command is confusing. Its method of promotion is based on loyalty rather than merit. And so when the security situation deteriorates throughout 1960, it's clear that Vietnam's military is incapable of dealing with this growing insurgency, and therefore evident the country had a poorly led military oriented toward the wrong kind of threat. Mm-hmm. So what strikes me so hard about this failure example is if you step back for a moment and imagine if this one had worked. Mm-hmm. Right, so imagine if the U.S. had actually done a decent job building the South Vietnamese military in the 50s. Right? At a minimum, you have 58,000 Americans who are here. Right? You don't have what becomes the Vietnam War. And to me, that was such a kind of striking example of the need to do this kind of thing better. So that's one of the big cases I look at. I look at two other types of failures also. The U.S. effort in Lebanon in the early 1980s. And then also a contemporary U.S. effort that begins in about 2005 or so. Mm-hmm. And in those, you have a kind of a wide range of challenges, in particularly confusion over why the U.S. is trying to build this military. You have this overwhelming issue of external actors who are trying to undermine the effort, and who are kind of just doing all they can to get the United States not to focus on this issue. Bunch of issues kind of along those lines. And then I have, well, there's the closest thing to success, which is the U.S. effort to build the Greek military just after World War II. Mm-hmm. And what happens here is, World War II has just ended. Greece is a mess. This is not the Greece of your summer vacation. Mm-hmm. This is a country just in hideous shape. So infrastructure is destroyed, ravaged landscape, rampant starvation and disease. 300,000 people had died from starvation. Military is just in terrible shape. Small, it has low morale, it's poorly paid. The best quote I found about it was from Dean Acheson. He says, "Greece was in the position of a semi-conscious patient on the critical list whose relatives and physicians had been discussing whether his life could be saved." Mm-hmm. So it's a really ugly situation. There's communist guerrillas that the Greek military is trying and failing. In its fight against, and they're getting help from Albania, Yugoslavia, and Bulgaria. And what strikes me as I'm researching this one is I see a really kind of different posture the U.S. takes toward this effort. Effectively, the U.S. gets extremely involved in sensitive Greek military affairs. Mm-hmm. It gets into all of the Greek military's knickers, if you will. The military's mission, the organization of the military, personnel, moving people around, pushing for the removal and promotion of different officers at various levels. And so that really strikes me, that willingness to get into all these sensitive Greek military affairs. Mm-hmm. You see this issue of a unified U.S. vision where across the key players, both inside Athens and Washington, a lot of kind of hard conversations about why they're building this military and how they're doing it. Questions on the nature of U.S. military involvement and whether or not it should become a co-combatant. And also a real recognition of the role of kind of the external threat environment, of the support that various external actors are giving to the guerrillas and why that matters. So it's not seen in just a bilateral lens. And what's, you know, kind of incredible here is the U.S. becomes deeply involved in these sensitive Greek military affairs. And that transforms the Greek military, enables it to then defeat the guerrillas. And this is an effort that is consists almost entirely of treasure, not blood. Mm-hmm. You have only 4 casualties on the U.S. side in this effort, and that costs a couple $100 million, and it's a success. Mm-hmm. So I look at kind of these 4 discrete cases and walk through them, and then walk away with some sort of provocative views on how the U.S. can do a better job trying to build militaries in fragile states.
So of these cases, within the United States, who are the major players as far as organizations involved in each of them? Is there a consistency, or is it wildly different in some way?
There is some consistency, particularly depending on the significance of the effort. But you will always see the State Department involved, and that's both state main state in Washington and also the embassy, the ambassador in particular. You will always see the Defense Department involved, and that includes a multiplicity of actors. From the Secretary of Defense and the Office of the Secretary of Defense, which is really kind of his key staff, to the Joint Staff, to the U.S. military representative in the country. So serving in the embassy, a defense attaché or a security assistance officer. And then you also see the kind of the coordinator of the effort in some very loose way, which is the National Security Council staff. So this is kind of the team at the White House that is trying to knit together why these efforts are going on, the purpose behind them, and ideally adjudicate differences. Of course, there is Congress, so outside the executive branch, Congress is obviously a key player because they hold the power of the purse, right? They decide what kind of assistance actually goes to these militaries. They might set restrictions on the level and nature and character of the cooperation. And so they're obviously intimately involved also.
Mm-hmm. Did you see any correlation as far as how interested the U.S. public was in a particular case with how well or how poorly the effort went?
That's a really interesting question. I did not look at that specifically. I'm curious. I'm trying to play out examples now in my head where you had substantial U.S. interest because you oftentimes, or excuse me, U.S. public interest because you oftentimes do not have that. I guess there's one that strikes me, which is Colombia. The U.S. gets very involved in building Colombia's military to deal with the narco traffickers. And because of just kind of the role that drugs play in America, you have a lot of kind of congressional support for this effort. You have a lot of congressional willingness to fund it and to make it kind of as substantial as possible. But outside of that, I'm not sure I have great examples where there's been that kind of correlation. I will say I can think of examples where the sort of spectacular events as it relates to one of these efforts to build a military has hit the American public hard and then potentially soured them. So a good example here would be Lebanon 1983. So in April 83, you have the U.S. Embassy being blown up. In October 83, you have the Marine Barracks bombing in which 241 U.S. military personnel get blown up in this kind of horrific attack. And that absolutely shifts kind of U.S. public support for U.S. military involvement in Lebanon.
So on the partner side, did you see any sort of trends as far as who the U.S. liked or preferred to deal with within, you know, the civilian or military side of those governments, these various governments?
And then was the U.S. more comfortable working with the military or the civilians in these different governments?
Yeah, like it did. I can imagine, you know, I can assume who they tended to work closely with to to develop these efforts, but were there any trends that, that might not seem obvious that you found?
Well, I think one is that you have different layers of cooperation, right? So you've got like tactical, operational cooperation, and then you've got strategic and sort of institutional level cooperation. And it was pretty clear from the research that when you get that institutional level advising, so advising in a Ministry of Defense, for example, it's going to have an outsized effect. So it's all well and good at a very tactical level to give a military, you know, a weapon or a platform, teach them, train them on how to use it, and then they are now able to employ it successfully and responsibly and appropriately. It's different and more meaningful when you're able to do that at a Ministry of Defense level, when you're advising them on how to develop their force more broadly and where to make investments and how to focus their mission, and of course, who their leadership is and why.
Mm-hmm. And you said all your cases are post-World War II, correct?
They are. I wanted to keep it as kind of contemporary as possible, mm-hmm. but I didn't want to just be anchored to the post 9/11 period, because I do think there's been a little bit of a false belief that it was really kind of post 9/11 that made the U.S. military start to work to build other militaries in fragile states, mm-hmm. and that just wasn't accurate. It's an older story, and it's important to recognize that it's an older story, not one that has to be tied just into sort of Iraq or Afghanistan or a war on terror.
And also, did you see any trends or the amount of violence that these developing militaries had to deal with? Did you see trends as far as, you know, I would assume that the greater the violence, the more difficult it would be for them to grow or develop. But is that the case? You know, what did you see in that regard?
Mm-hmm. I think this is a particularly interesting question because it's not entirely what you would expect. Mm-hmm. So actually, when you have growing violence, when you have a particularly destabilizing situation, you get a level of desperation mm-hmm. on the part of the partner state's leadership, where they are actually more willing to collaborate, more willing to kind of hear those uncomfortable questions and requests from the United States mm-hmm. because they are so fearful of kind of what the future portends. You know, it's worth noting that generally the examples I look at are pretty ugly. And so when you're looking between kind of options that are really ugly and sort of catastrophic, really ugly is a better situation. Hmm. And I note that because when we look kind of at any of the examples, you know, one that are kind of seen as successes, and I use that term sort of in quotes, it's not a terrific situation, right? If you look at the Greek military, you know, for the next few decades after this effort, and they don't necessarily behave the way that we want in a bunch of examples. Mm-hmm. But you don't have a state that has completely failed.
Mm-hmm. Right. You can continue to engage with diplomacy rather than, you know, with troops.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's such a key point.
So did you find situations where the United States was forced to compete with partners or an adversary who wanted to be the one to really develop this fragile state's military, whatever the case might be? Or was it always, you know, the U.S. was in charge in these cases?
So I found a number of examples where the U.S. goes in because another country has tried to build a military and hasn't. So we saw this with the French in South Vietnam. We see this with the Brits in Greece. So that was kind of curious to me. Mm-hmm. What I saw in particular in the more contemporary examples was there's a little bit of competition mm-hmm. for you know, I'll use the Russians, for example. So the Russians are working a little bit with the Lebanese military mm-hmm. over the last decade and a half. They're not giving them much, and what they're giving them is not terribly high quality, mm-hmm. but they've sort of introduced a level of competition into the space, and that, you know, that can have some kind of problematic effects. Mm-hmm. What I do see a lot of in all the examples are various state actors that are trying to support you know, if you will, the bad guys who are working against this U.S. effort.
Hmm.
So, for example, you know, in Lebanon over the last few decades, you've got the Iranians who are working with Hezbollah, or Syria who's working with Hezbollah, you know, trying to, and having successfully, I would argue, build a really, really capable, you know, violent non-state actor that in many ways is working against the exact effort the U.S. is trying to in terms of kind of securing and stabilizing Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. So another question about trends. Did you find, is there sort of a general pattern the U.S. follows as far as they go in small, start to grow as things don't work, or, you know, maybe they don't grow, things are working, and, or, you know, does it, you just see a continually rising effort, or what do you see in that regard?
Mm-hmm. So it gets, you know, inevitably there are ups and downs based on the context, right? So what's the security situation looking like, based on the people involved, based on U.S. national security interests, which, you know, waxes and wanes for better or worse, especially around, you know, post-election. What you often see, though, is that there will be sort of bursts of interest on the U.S. side for a couple of years and then a real downturn in interest. And so, you know, that's, of course, frustrating for the partner military, and, you know, it's frustrating for folks who are working on these efforts, but the literature, I think, is just short-sighted when it makes comments about the need to have kind of a long-term committed investment. That's just not practical. And so if we're going to acknowledge that that's not practical, then what do we do to work within the system? You know, you're not going to transform the way the U.S. system is set up, right? It's a system of checks and balances. It always will be that. And we can express frustrations with that, but we don't want it to, you know, we can't expect to change that.
Did you see marked changes with administration changes? Or was there more consistency, whether it was failing or succeeding? Did you see, you know, what do you see in that regard?
Mm-hmm. So the broader effort of kind of working with militaries and federal state, you do see as a constant across administrations post-1945.
Mm-hmm.
The emphasis changes based on the administration, but I think that is less of a partisan issue and more of a more animated by the international security environment at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So post 9/11, the Bush administration, and you see this in a lot of Secretary Gates's writings and speeches, the Bush administration really prioritizes this issue of trying to work with partner militaries in fragile states. And that makes sense, right? There's been this spectacular, hideous attack on America. There's sort of this recognition that you need to kind of fight various bad guys in various places, and so working by, with, and through others is seen as the way to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. It seems that despite, you know, what might be characterized as big changes in the government based on who's been elected president, security seems to be, like you say, there's a change in emphasis, but the security goals seem to stay consistent. Like there's this something is making sure that consistency exists in these efforts.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, it is often surprising to see how much consistency there can be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we're in an interesting moment, to put it lightly, right now,
mm-hmm.
With a lack of consistency, and it's we kind of have a natural experiment, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Do you think sort of the civil service, the U.S. civil service, is responsible, is the reason for consistency, or do you think that the sort of the U.S. politicians in general kind of feel the same way in general about security issues? You know, the people who are put in place by the voters.
Right. So I think that's shifting a little bit. You know, there was much more consistency on national security, much more consistency for kind of periods of time. So you had this from, say, 1945 until the fall of the Soviet Union. The 90s, I think, are just a really confused period for thinking about what that security environment looks like. Mm-hmm. Right after 9/11, of course, you have a ton of consensus, arguably too much consensus, right, on how to respond and what to do. Mm-hmm. But when you look like at Congress, for example, that sort of bipartisan national security consensus, and that sort of cohort that kind of thought a certain way about national security affairs has diminished markedly. You don't have that type of bipartisan agreement anymore. There are a handful of exceptions. I would say the Senate Armed Services Committee is probably one exception these days. But on the whole, this sort of widespread recognition of how to think about national security affairs, and frankly, a recognition that they're really, really important and America's role in the world is really important, I think we've seen a real diminishment of that, unfortunately.
It's interesting. Are there significant secondary issues in your book that maybe we haven't touched on yet that you might want to mention?
Absolutely. So there are two that I would emphasize. You know, one of my big takeaways in this book is that the United States, in working with partners, needs to be comfortable mucking around in their sensitive affairs. And what I mean by that is not blustery and not acting, you know, like a colonial power will. But the United States needs to recognize it has a little bit of leverage, and it should be comfortable pushing partners in certain directions, or at a minimum articulating what it thinks those directions should be. So that's a little bit of a posture change, if you will, for the United States. The other thing I would note is, you know, this is obviously a book that's looking at state building through a certain lens, right? How to build a partner military. Ideally, this effort is nested under a much broader an endeavor to build a state, right, and to strengthen a state's institutions across the board. And it should be listed under that chapeau, and yet that quite rarely is the case for a number of reasons, both inside the United States and with the partner military, with partners, there's often a desire to work with a partner military, but not to work, say, with a partner's judiciary. And I do believe, you know, there is something not terrific about building only one institution in a state and that strong, capable institution beating the guys with guns.
Right. Yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. So let me ask you about the resources you used to do your research. You know, how did you go about doing it?
Depended on the case. I mean, obviously, to begin with, there was a whole lot of literature review, especially through state building literature, federal state literature, et cetera. And then when I had sort of narrowed the cases, it really depended on the case. So for the Greek example, you know, this was spending a lot of time in dusty archives. The Greek archives were actually really helpful also in the library. Were just terrific out in Athens. So Greece, I would say, was kind of heavily focused on documents. The South Vietnam case was also pretty heavily focused on documents from oral interviews. The two Lebanon cases were different. Those involved a lot of field research in Lebanon. A lot of the documents hadn't been declassified yet. Particularly for the contemporary Lebanon example. So interviews were really, really important along those lines, both of Americans and also of Lebanese. So that both of those involved, you know, finding declassified documents when possible and going through archives, but a ton of interviews across both the American national security apparatus and also the Lebanese national security apparatus. So I was very excited to get to go and spend very extensive time doing field research in Lebanon, which is, I think, the most interesting country in the world.
So did you happen to come across any particularly interesting documents or just objects or anything during your research that, you know, that you found pretty exciting to come across?
Oh, there were so many. The document that hit me hard was I had been doing a bunch of interviews about the U.S. effort in Lebanon. So I was focused particularly on this period of early 1984. So I had done some interviews with various Lebanese military officials at that time, and they were talking about what was going on And they said there were all these debates by the head of the military and the cohort around him and the Americans over this gap. It was a gap in one part of Beirut in which it appeared that their bad guys were kind of sneaking through to then conduct attacks. But I had only heard this come up in discussions with Lebanese. And so I really wanted to find a way to triangulate. And I was amazed one day. I was going through declassified CIA documents. And I find a declassified document that literally is highlighting the gap. And talking all about it and how all sorts of kind of nefarious actors had gone through this gap to conduct attacks. And it was just really neat to kind of hear about this from the Lebanese and then see it in declassified U.S. documents. I was also struck, you know, I've spent a number of years studying Lebanon, particularly that time period, and it was amazing to hear a couple stories that at least I don't think had ever been reported before. I know I had never seen them. So when the U.S. was building the Lebanese military in the early 1980s, there was one U.S. official who actually tried to get the head of the Lebanese military to conduct a coup. That's astonishing, and that was totally against U.S. policy. And yet, through triangulation, in my research, I had multiple people tell me this. So that was just, you know, kind of mind-boggling.
Did you, you didn't happen to be able to ask this person about this, did you? Or if this person is still alive? You said this was in the 80s, right?
Mm-hmm. It was, yes. It was in the early 80s. I was able to interview a number of people who worked around this and who were able to verify from different perspectives that this had occurred. Kind of astonishing.
Okay.
It's, you know, it's a reminder that when we say U.S. policy, what do we really mean? Right? There are a lot of different people touching it, and influencing it. You know, when I looked at the South Vietnam case, there was an interesting example. The fellow who's running the U.S. effort to build South Vietnam's military is also not interested in what Washington's guidance is. And that was striking how often this happened. I had also found in my work where you've got a disconnect between the field and headquarters, and you're saying, hey, here's U.S. policy, but who's actually implementing it and how?
Yeah, it seems interesting that in these fragile states that, you know, even a minor U.S. official, the words of a minor U.S. official could really affect some, you know, like a promise or some comment could inadvertently, like, set off something that wasn't expected.
It's incredible, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
So what part of the research did you find most enjoyable? It sounds like Lebanon was, but... if you'd like to expand on that.
Gosh, I mean, I think, you know, so much of it is fun, right? I mean, just, you know, when you're digging through documents and interviewing folks. I think, if I can use the term enjoyable loosely.
Sure.
I really enjoyed studying something I had worked on. So I had played a key role in this effort to build the Lebanese military, this contemporary effort. And so I knew my own perspective and I knew my own biases. And what I thought was really neat is then I became a researcher. I was able to step back and look at my own actions and also interview a bunch of other people who were touching it. And that was just fascinating, you know, because you just recognize that you have a perspective and you have a lens. And that is an imperfect perspective and a sort of hazy lens.
Did you hear anything that abruptly changed your mind about some approach, or was it just more like, okay, yeah, that makes sense, I'll learn from it?
I would say it clarified some sort of rumblings that I had started to recognize. So one of the people I interviewed had this comment about why the U.S. was building the Lebanese military, and he said something to the effect of, you know, when we were having our discussions about this, at the very highest level, we would say, we're building the Lebanese military to exert the government's sovereignty throughout its territory. And then we would go right down to, how much ammunition do they need? And we never really had those hard conversations about what was this military going to do. Mm-hmm. And how are we going to help it do that? Mm-hmm. And I remember him saying that, and it just hit me like a ton of bricks. He was exactly right. There was also one that was a little tough to hear, to be honest. The U.S. in the summer of 2007 worked really hard to get a bunch of assistance to Lebanon's military. So we sent about 40 C-130s and C-17s filled with material to Lebanon incredibly quickly, which doesn't usually happen, and it would land at the airport and go right to help the Lebanese military in this fight that it was waging in Nahabad refugee camp. Mm-hmm. And I had seen that as such an extraordinary example of how quickly the U.S. system could move, and yet in interview after interview after interview on the Lebanese side, it was criticized just left and right. It was too slow. There wasn't enough. The head of the Lebanese military said at one point, you know, it's as though the Americans are telling us die first and assistance will follow. And so that was really sobering and important to hear.
Do you think that just looking at Vietnam with the introduction of sort of operations research by McNamara, which I guess a lot of times people mm-hmm. will just consider, body counts, like
yeah.
what have we lost? What have they lost? Do you think that mindset has had a detrimental effect on this issue that you've studied, or has it at all?
I think that's a superb question. And yes, I think that mindset absolutely has played into how the Pentagon has approached this issue. I will say, with real kudos both to Congress for some important changes they made legislatively over the last 2 years, and also to Secretary Mattis with some changes that he's been making inside the department, I think there's a real increased recognition that the United States needs to kind of do a better job of building these militaries, and it can do so by shifting its perspective, by rethinking its metrics, by not being so tied to these kind of very tangible, quantitative, almost ops research-like like details.
Okay.
You know, that's a piece of the story, but it's an incomplete piece of the story, and I think there's increasing recognition of that.
What did you find that was most surprising in your research?
The entire argument I'm making, which is effectively the United States needs to be comfortable mucking about in sensitive military affairs with the Pentagon military,
mm-hmm.
is pretty much the exact opposite of what I would have thought. So that's pretty provocative. I mean, I would have thought that when a military is thinking about who the next head should be or other kind of key leadership positions, when it's really trying to wrestle with its mission, I would have thought the U.S. should keep a bit of distance. And yet my research would actually argue for the opposite, that the United States should share its views, and that it is useful to at least start to have those hard conversations on these higher order questions.
At what point in your research did you decide, you know what, my initial thesis was off base, and, and this is the idea I'm going with?
Right. I had gotten a piece of advice that I did not follow by an incredibly smart and thoughtful fellow. And he said, you start with the case you know the least about.
Mm-hmm.
So my lesson learned for the future is that you start with the case you know the least about.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really when I got to when I had already spent a lot of time on both Lebanon cases, and then I started to get deep into Greece. And the deeper I got into Greece, the more I started to realize that what I was hypothesizing was actually totally wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's uncomfortable. I don't know if you've read The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, but there's, this fantastic book that invents the term paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, the author, Thomas Kuhn, talks about incommensurability. So effectively, you have this idea and you keep putting appendages onto this idea. And after a point, you've got just incommensurability, right? You've got this Frankenstein, and the Frankenstein just doesn't make sense. I remember sort of sitting there and saying, yeah, this actually is not at all what I'm saying. And wow. I think I was probably particularly struck on the Greek front when I was seeing just how much mucking about the U.S. military had done with the Greek personnel. Mm-hmm. I mean, just effectively overseeing a complete overhaul of the military personnel in Greece, appointing a new chief of staff, compelling all of the army's lieutenant generals except one to resign, facilitating the promotion and placement of 8 major generals, encouraged the removal of division and corps commanders who were reluctant or incapable of supporting a broader strategy. I was reading through all that, and it felt totally incommensurable.
So what would you say, and you maybe already talked about this, but what was the most difficult thing to research, sort of an issue that maybe you still don't feel comfortable with, or something that just really took a lot of time?
I'd say an issue that I don't feel comfortable with, or really just that there's more to follow, is the contemporary case. So the U.S. effort to build the Lebanese military that really kicks off in 2006. It starts in a very nascent way in 2005 after former Prime Minister Refik Hariri is assassinated, but it doesn't really come to fruition until 2006 or so. And I think there's more to be said about that because it is still a contemporary debate, right? So Congress today is still debating the extent to which the United States should work with the Lebanese military and what the nature and character of that relationship should look like. And so because it's a live conversation, I think there's continually more to write on it, but you have to snap a chalk line somewhere.
Was there anything you found that emotionally moved you in your research, either something sad or something that really made you happy to find out?
I would say what I found to be probably the saddest is when I was doing interviews in Lebanon about this period of the early 1980s, which is just this like hideous moment in Lebanese history, the civil war. I mean, you can't count all your fingers and all your toes how many different groups are fighting against one another. And it was just, it was such a complicated situation. And even in retrospect, it's so hard to understand. It made me so empathetic to the folks who were trying to make policy at that moment in time. But the example that hit me the hardest was the night that President Reagan authorizes the USS New Jersey to start firing on the Syrian military and on militias in Lebanon. He writes in his diary, this still falls under the heading of self-defense. And that just struck me so hard because, you've got U.S. personnel that are getting attacked left and right in Lebanon. You've got the Marines who are there as part of his peacekeeping effort who are getting combat pay. And yet the president is somehow trying to tell himself, oh, no, this is all separate, right? Our adversaries will be able to distinguish between those who are here for one purpose and those who are here for another. And it was sort of heartbreaking because there's no way that was going to be the case.
So in Lebanon, is the current Syrian conflict exacerbated issues in Lebanon, do you think? Or has the pressure kind of been taken off for a little bit, with Syria preoccupied with its own issues,
I would argue it's exacerbated it, but it's actually also brought a lot of these issues to the fore in all sorts of uncomfortable ways. So, for example, you've got a pretty heavy refugee flows from Syria into Lebanon, and that includes some sort of nefarious actors, and so increased worries about Lebanese stability. But where the dynamics have gotten really interesting and complicated is Hezbollah, so an organization that is on, like, the U.S. foreign terrorist organization list, has been fighting ISIS, which is also an entity the United States has been fighting. And so you're suddenly on the same team with an actor that you, like, virulently oppose. And so that's kind of complicated. Right. Moreover, you've got the Lebanese military, at a minimum deconflicting, at a maximum coordinating with Hezbollah to work against ISIS and ISIS remnants. That's interesting and complicated. I would say another example as it relates to Syria is right now you have 2,000 U.S. military personnel in Syria. And it's hard to look at them and their very fuzzy mission of stabilization and presence and not worry that there's an analogous situation to what happened with the Marines in Beirut in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. So at the risk of making this a Lebanon-focused podcast, you know, what is the importance of Lebanon, you know, ultimately? It seems, I'd say the average person would, if they even knew much about Lebanon, would think, well, it's just this small country on the coast, and they don't seem to, mm-hmm. you know, what importance are they?
Why
is the U.S.?
Care?
Yeah, why does the U.S. care about, you know, stabilizing Lebanon? Is it just because of Israel, or you know?
So, I would say, you know, what's interesting about Lebanon is there is arguably not an issue in the Middle East that somehow Lebanon is not touching.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's issues of democratization, issues of terrorism, Iran, everyone is mucking about there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have seen kind of instability in Lebanon directly affect U.S. national security interests.
Mm-hmm.
So Lebanon being a wasteland is what allowed the Iranians to go in and build Hezbollah. Hezbollah, before 9/11, is responsible for more American deaths than any other organization. So even if you say, hey, it's a tiny country, far away, why do I care? Well, I care because a lot of Americans were killed because of what came out of Lebanon, because of its instability. I care because Hezbollah worked to train and equip a whole bunch of bad guys to help kill American servicemen and women in Iraq throughout the previous decade and a half. So it's a place where if you don't pay a close eye to it, bad things will emerge, and bad things will end up hitting you somehow. You know, and the example we've seen with the Iranians and Hezbollah is now being replicated over and over, where the Iranians are able to now work with Hezbollah and work with a bunch of other groups to effectively project Iranian power across the entire Middle East.
Do you think Lebanon will ultimately stabilize only when there's peace in the Middle East, or can Lebanon exist ever as a stable, safe, you know, nation?
It's a complicated place. I mean, you've got about 5 million people. We don't know because there hasn't been a census in about 80 years. And about 18 different groups, they're known as confessions. And so no matter what, there's a ton of instability in the system. The question is what type of instability? Like, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm.
And at a minimum, you know, you don't want bad things that are leaking out of Lebanon that affect U.S. national security interests.
Mm-hmm.
So this will get a whole lot more interesting, obviously, given the situation in Syria, given how the Assad regime is exerting increasing control throughout Syria, we're going to see what happens here with Iran and with Hezbollah.
All right. So what do you ultimately hope the book will do? Do you want it to affect the lay reader, or do you want it to affect policymakers? You know, what's your goal with it?
I hope it affects policymakers in that I hope it encourages them to reconceptualize how they work with partners in fragile states, how they are working with these militaries. I hope it makes them more willing to raise crucial higher order questions when they are working with these militaries, and to make a clear-eyed assessment about the goals and the likely outcomes of U.S. military assistance.
Mm-hmm.
Those clear-eyed assessments might involve still moving forward with limited efforts to work with partner militaries, and that's absolutely fine as long as there's, you know, an eyes wide open approach.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, those efforts, those clear-eyed assessments might also lead U.S. policymakers to say, actually, you know, this isn't worth it. We're not getting much out of this effort. Mm-hmm. And having a limited impact by building this military through such a narrow aperture isn't worth the money that we're spending or the effort that we're spending.
Mm-hmm. Is your book more of an academic type book, or is it more sort of a narrative of sorts? How would you describe it?
I would say it is academically grounded,
mm-hmm.
but it's written in a way to appeal to the interested layperson.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively, it's got all of the sort of rigor that an academic text needs to have,
mm-hmm.
but it's written in a digestible way of telling interesting stories with, I think, meaningful findings.
Mm-hmm. What's your next writing project? Have you thought about that? You must have, I'm sure.
I am. I'm brainstorming the next writing project now. It'll probably involve the legacy of the last decade and a half of conflict.
Say that again, I'm sorry.
It'll probably involve the legacy of the last decade and a half plus of conflict. Effectively, what has the United States inherited from being at war for almost two decades?
Hmm. Have you started the research, or is it just kind of something you're approaching?
It's in the brainstorming phase.
Okay. Where can people find your various articles and writing and that sort of thing?
You know, there's not actually an organized place. I should probably do that. It will often be on the Johns Hopkins site website or on the Brookings Institution website. My page on the on Brookings website will always link to my recent pieces.
Okay. Did you want to mention some of the blogs that you write on? Because I've seen your articles on mm-hmm. some blogs.
Sure. I've been really honored to write for a wide variety of outlets like Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy and Defense One. So folks can find my writings in you know, across all of those.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts?
I don't think so. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate your thoughtful question.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for listening. One of the best ways to provide feedback on this podcast is to rate it on iTunes. Please let me know if you liked it, or give me a poor rating if you didn't like this podcast, and I can use that feedback to hopefully get better. Otherwise, please follow me on Instagram at Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, on Twitter at War Scholar, on Facebook under War Scholar, and you can find more information on my website, warscholar.org. Please remember, my name Chris does not have an H, so it's CrisAlvarez. Thank you, and I hope you continue to enjoy this podcast.